It's time for Security Now. Steve Gibson is here. We're going to talk about the strange case of the Estonian ID cards. A weird bug or actually flaw introduced into Microsoft's Windows 10. We're still not sure exactly who got it and why. We'll also talk about the case of the Firefox plugin promoting Mr. Robot. A whole lot more, all coming up next on Security Now.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Security Now is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 642, recorded Tuesday, December 19th, 2017, BGP. Security Now is brought to you by WordPress. Plans start at just $4 a month. Get 15% off your brand new website today at wordpress.com/securitynow. And by IT Pro TV. A good IT pro is always learning, and IT Pro TV is the resource to keep you and your IT team's skills up to date. Visit itpro.tv/securitynow and use the code SN30 to get a free 7-day trial and 30% off a monthly membership for the lifetime of your active subscription. And by Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully so you can be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/securitynow. It's time for Security Now, the show where we cover your security online with this guy right here, the explainer-in-chief, Steve Gibson. Happy holidays, Steve.
Hey, Leo, I get to say now that this is the penultimate episode of 2017, which we've all learned is not the last one, but it's the second to last one. So, yeah. Next week, we're going to do a fun blast from the past special for people who haven't listened for, I think it was 7 years ago, that we discussed something. We'll let it be a little bit of a surprise for anyone who has joined us in the last 7 years, missed this particular episode that we're going to repeat. Not the portable dog killer, not any of the other things that we've repeated before. This is a first-time repetition. So I think it's going to be good. But this week, for the penultimate episode, I want to talk about something that we've touched on by necessity through the years in the 12-plus years we've been doing this. Wait, no, we're in year 12, so 11-plus years. And that is BGP, the Border Gateway Protocol. It's in the news because of a recent mistake. Well, no, actually, it wasn't a mistake. And that's what sort of raised that it's the fact that it wasn't a mistake that puts it more on our map. This is significant because the protocol has been around from the beginning of the internet. It's at version 4, BGP4, where it's been for a long time. It's sort of done. There have been security efforts made, but none that have gained traction. So it's surprisingly kind of out there hanging, just waiting to get blasted. And there have been attacks on it, subversions of it through the years, which is why we've touched on it a little bit. But I thought on the occasion of a clear, probably state-based, deliberate subversion, we need to just plant a stronger flag in this and talk about it, because I think it's very clear that as we move sort of toward a world of state-sponsored manipulation of the internet, we're going to be seeing more border gateway protocol based attacks. So that's our main topic. But of course, we've got lots of news, as we always do. We're going to talk about how Estonia handled the Infineon crypto bug, which crippled so many of the smart cards that we've talked about for the last couple of months. They came up with their own approach, which I wish the other I'm sure the other countries are thinking, oh, why didn't we think of that? It's because it's kind of clever. We've got a couple new consequences of the recent pressure to maliciously mine cryptocurrency as a consequence of the crazy valuation of the Bitcoin and Monero and other cryptos. Actually two zero-day exploits in the very popular and latest version of the vBulletin forum system, which those guys, the vBulletin maintainers, did not respond to. So the guys who found these problems lost patience and just said, well, here it is, and they're bad. And so all vBulletin forum systems are currently vulnerable to these zero-day exploits. Mozilla, believe it or not, is in the doghouse over Mr. Robot, which is not a phrase I thought I would ever hear myself saying, but yes, it's true. We'll talk about that. And then Win10 had a weird thing happen where they bundled what turned out to be an insecure password manager by mistake. That got caught by the guys at Google. And I also want to talk about when a legacy protocol comes back to bite us, as some more, actually, Project Zero guys at Google found. Also, a way to bulk steal any Chrome user's entire stored password vault, which is sort of simple, and Google said, yeah, we're not fixing that. So I just want to make sure our listeners understand that this is possible. Also, we finally know where and why the uber-potent Mirai botnet was created and by whom. So that we kind of in time for Christmas, we get to put a little bow on that one. We also have a bit of errata, some fun miscellaneous stuff. And as I said, we're going to then finish by taking a look at BGP, which is, you know, another critical yet crucial and vulnerable protocol that glues the entire global internet together. So I think as our penultimate podcast of 2017, we've got a goodie.
Yeah. Well, you know what else glues the entire internet, or at least the World Wide Web together? WordPress, 29%.
It's kind of mind-boggling
that any one content management system could control 29% of the internet. But that's exactly what WordPress does. And I've been a WordPress customer, a happy WordPress user for, I guess it would be more than a decade. I can't remember when I first started using WordPress. I was on our SoftLayer servers. I installed, the downloadable WordPress. And I found actually over time that mostly what I was doing is maintaining it, like paying a lot for the server, but then also maintaining the code base, updating it, adding plugins and stuff, and not as much time as I might have wanted to blog, to post. So fortunately, WordPress.com does all the technical stuff so I can focus on my content. And that's good news for you, too. If you're a business, a blogger, or both, you got to know about WordPress.com. It's a great place to make your website. For your business particularly, it has great business plans. That's where I put my site, leolaporte.com. But it's not just my site. 29% of the entire web uses WordPress. I was really surprised the other day. I was reading the Facebook research report from Facebook Research on a Facebook-branded site. Lo and behold, I got to the bottom and said, WordPress. WordPress VIP. It comes off WordPress.com. So even Facebook uses WordPress because it's a great content management system. Makes it easy for you to post. Makes it easy for you to set up a site. Create a custom template or use one of their hundreds of existing templates, plugins. You don't have to be an expert. You just have to be interested in posting and creating a site. And I would encourage you, if you're a business, to be doing that. You need to have a place on the web that you own. Even Facebook doesn't put its stuff on Facebook. Where are you doing that? Put it on your own site. You can cross-post to Facebook and Twitter. And, with WordPress, you get social linking that makes it easy for your visitors to promote your site, your content, on their Facebook and their Twitter. So you really, it's a lever that you can move the world with. The business plan gives you access to hundreds of plugins and themes. I have AMP turned on. That's the Google platform that speeds up page load times on a mobile. It's easy. I don't have to do anything. Just click a box and AMP is there. HTTPS, as you know, if you listen to this show, secure browsing is, you know, kind of de rigueur for websites these days. And even Google gives you better search result rankings if you're using TLS. So I do, because it was easy. It comes with WordPress. I didn't have to do anything. And the WordPress experts are so helpful. I've contacted them a couple of times, and they're fast. They really help you 24 hours a day, Monday through Friday, and on weekends too. I can go on and on, but here's the deal. You can go try it right now. Price is as low as $4 a month. You can get started right now with 15% off any new plan purchase. Just go to wordpress.com/security now. That's wordpress.com/security now. Create the website and find the plan that's right for you. Tell the world what you're up to at wordpress.com/security now for 15% off your brand new website. Thank WordPress for making the penultimate security now a reality. Penultimate
they do a good,
for the year.
They do a good job. I don't know if you mentioned it, but with spam handling.
Oh, Kismet is great. Yeah, they're
of blog plugin. Postings.
Yeah, yeah,
I you know, because I have two WordPress sites for two blogs, and they're, you know, very rarely does anything get through their spam filter.
Yeah.
So that's
important, because nice. Unfortunately spam is a real problem in blogs.
It's a reality.
Yeah.
This picture of the week, I've just had in my archive. Sometimes more than one comes in that's just too fun. And so I have a backlog, and no particular picture caught my eye this week. So I thought, okay, I'm going to pull one out of the archive that we've never shown before. I just got a kick out of it. It's just very clever. It shows a CAPTCHA license plate with the explanation, to ensure that a human is writing my ticket. And so the guy is holding up a Texas license plate. It says the Lone Star State down below. And you could imagine that some image recognition license plate snapping, you know, one of those photo ticketing stoplight cameras could be challenged by this. I mean, we can kind of say, oh, that's BJN1484. But, ooh, boy, you know, if you're not up to speed, especially if you're not expecting to have a highly obscured license plate, well, yes, that's the CAPTCHA. So I thought that was very clever.
We are not advocating this. I think it's probably illegal, but go ahead. Yeah. You can't modify your license plate like that. Sure.
You can, yes. I'm sure you cannot obscure it to make it difficult to. Right. You know, I have GRC.com, and I did put
a dot on ours too.
Color matching dot right in the middle. And the one guy drove past me and was all incensed and said he was going to report me. And I thought, really? Because, I mean, if anything, it makes it more memorable rather than less memorable.
Yeah,
it's not just suddenly
there,
it's not just six unrelated letters. It's, you know, clearly a domain. But anyway, can't make everybody happy.
What?
Hello?
Hello?
Oh, I'm sorry. I wasn't sure if we had lost our connection.
I just stopped making noise.
Oh, Leo. I'm so
I'm still alive.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Okay, so the case of the Estonia ID card. Estonia, as we've talked about before, is a very crypto technology progressive country, and they just jumped on all kinds of latest technological solutions. Well, they got bit in this case as a consequence of the very widespread use of the Infineon library-based crypto cards, which, as we know, generated a weak private key, a weak public key, which was factorable down to discover the private key that was hidden within it. So there was some good coverage of this, and I just wanted to I'm going to share what was written, because it explains Estonia's position. The coverage wrote, the Estonia ID card is used nationwide for both governmental and private sector services. Several critical processes rely on the operability of the digital identity infrastructure, while some of the systems support the ID card exclusively. In Estonia, mobile ID is also available for authentication and digital signatures in many but not all services. So they explain that shutting down all ID cards, which this problem would have created, would have had a severe impact on the entire country, including the economic impact to businesses, probably resulting in the deployment of substitute measures with lesser security standards while making several services more costly and time-consuming. So they'd bought full in to the use of this secure crypto smart card for all kinds of identity, for signing contracts and so forth. So they write, replacing all the cards physically would have taken a long time, given the necessary steps for creating an entirely new card, choosing the chip, programming and testing the application, acquiring the necessary certification and procuring the new cards equipped with the new chips. Only after those steps would the actual replacement procedure take place, limited by the low amount of available personnel in the border and police service points. They wrote, according to our estimates, the process would have taken at least a year, if not more, to complete. The alternative was to create a solution that would bypass the vulnerability by updating the existing cards. There is a requirement that keys, and this is key for, basically the guarantee. They wrote that there is a requirement that keys must be generated on the card and never leave the card. This is required in order to be able to use the ID card to give legally binding digital signatures. The vulnerability that we, they wrote, had to bypass was found in the on-chip RSA key generation procedure. We had to abandon using RSA altogether. Thankfully, the ID card chip also supported elliptic curve cryptography, which was not affected by the vulnerability that had been discovered. The solution was to update the cards to use elliptic curve crypto instead of RSA. We analyzed the possibilities to continue with RSA by using alternative key lengths, but ruled them out for several considerations. They said, for example, there's no capability of generating 3K-bit keys within the chip. So, and the problem was that the only way to solve the problem that it was too easy to factor the output would have been to dramatically increase the size of the primes in order to bring the difficulty back up. But these chips couldn't do that. So they said, moreover, the decisions had to be made before, and I love this, before the article on the vulnerability was published. In that situation, migrating to ECC was the most viable decision. So in our initial coverage, we talked about how the stakeholders in this library, the major producers of the cards and the countries that were using them, did have an early pre-announce window. And these guys are so committed to the security that they were okay relying on the known defective signing, the known defective encryption, as long as it wasn't made public. So their window of in which they had to fix this was when this knowledge would go generally public. So they said, devising the concept for the solution itself was done rather quickly, mainly due to the lack of alternatives. So there wasn't much to choose among. They said most of the time was spent on the development and testing of the ID card base software and card application, retuning the remote update system, updating the service provider system to support elliptic curves. So they had to update the infrastructure to support this and then basically reprogram the existing cards. They said the two core functions of the Estonian ID card are authentication and digital signatures. Legally binding digital signatures in Estonia have always been time-stamped. Retaining the authenticity of digitally signed documents even throughout this situation, as it is possible to provide evidence that the signature was given before the information about the vulnerability became available. So we had only talked about this Infineon library problem being a complete catastrophe and it basically shutting down everything. Because the Estonian government chose to, even though they used the Infineon library, the cards that they used also supported elliptic curve. They were able to move the entire country's infrastructure from a crypto based on the difficulty of prime factorization over to elliptic curve. They didn't talk about how, you know, the keys would have gotten much smaller as a consequence, which we know is the case because the elliptic curve problem is so much more difficult to solve that you need fewer bits, so essentially each bit is stronger than you do to protect against prime factorization. So I think this is probably the end of our discussing this Infineon problem, but it was nice to see that as a consequence of the fact that the processor in the smart card could do elliptic curve crypto, that they were able to essentially sidestep the problem. Certainly, I mean, it was a big deal to switch the entire country's infrastructure over, but they had many months of foreknowledge before the factorization problem became public, and that meant that before that happened, everybody was switched over. And thanks to the fact that signatures are time-stamped, they would be able always to know whether a signature, whether an RSA-based signature had happened after the disclosure or before, trusting it before and not after, and that crypto should have been moved to elliptic curve anyway by the time of the disclosure. So
very smart of them to have elliptic curve as an alternative device.
Yes.
I mean, that's really interesting that they put both RSA and elliptic curve.
Yeah, and I didn't include it in my notes here, but in their discussion that went on at some length, they recognized how fortunate they were and suggested that as a matter of policy, any similar future use of widespread crypto for applications like this should absolutely include the ability to update the technology. It's been the history of this podcast is we keep seeing protocols which were initially believed to be secure are found to have some problems. You know, we keep moving hashes up from, used to be MD4, then MD5, then SHA-1. Nobody wants to use any of those, although we all did at one point. Now it's SHA-256, and we're even looking to future next generations beyond that hashes. And the same thing with crypto. Some of our early podcasts talked about, all of the problems with the Wi-Fi protocols that, we were once using. It's like, oops, can't use that anymore. So I think it's very clear, we're learning lessons. We're learning that IoT devices have to have a means of keeping themselves current and updating themselves because they're computers, even though they look like toasters. So, similarly, a smart card has to have a way to be able to be updated when problems are discovered.
It's more than just an update. They had the capability in there, right? I mean,
yes.
They had to have the foresight to do that. I'm sure it cost more to do that. They had to have more memory and more capability, but they had the foresight to do that, which is really remarkable, really.
And to have chosen a chip one. That had a processor that was able to do it. Yeah.
Really impressive.
Yeah. So I read this and I thought, what? Except it was covered by Bleeping Computer that, these guys really know what they're talking about. Kaspersky Labs has discovered an evolved version of an older, from a couple years ago, 2015, older Android malware family, which at the time was known as PODEC, P-O-D-E-C. The updated strain goes by the name LOAPI, I guess, L-O-A-P-I. It has been found in a large number of apps hosted by third-party, not Google Play, repositories, Android app repositories, masquerading either as adult-themed apps or bogus antiviral utilities. But the kick here is, okay, so if users don't remove this from their Android devices, when left to its own means, this LOAPI malware, which is itself capable of all kinds of different malicious behavior, will eventually get around to downloading a Monero cryptocurrency miner, which it runs,
of course it will.
Ignoring all. Yes, exactly. As I said at the top of the show, there are two stories which are, as you know, a consequence of the pressure now to mine cryptocurrency. Yeah. You know, web browsers are doing it, and they're just trying to, you know, everybody's trying to sneak this in and steal CPU cycles. So this thing will overheat and overwork the phone's components, ignoring all power management throttling, which ends up making the battery bulge and deform the phone's cover, or worse. So, I mean, so it's literally ultimately destroying people's phones. The original malware, which was just used to bypass the advice of charge, so-called AOC, and CAPTCHAs, which then subscribed their victims to premium rate SMS services, where that was a couple years ago. Today, this LOAPI malware is far more advanced. Kaspersky experts called it a jack of all trades. It's, first of all, it can mine the Monero cryptocurrency. It can install a proxy to relay the phone's traffic, inject ads in notification areas, it can inject ads in other apps, open URLs in browsers also used to show ads, download and install other apps, launch DDoS attacks, interact with the phone's SMS functions, and crawl web pages, apparently to subscribe users to premium SMS services and more. So, you know, the real takeaway here, folks, is really be careful what you install, you know, like where you get your software. The fact that I saw a picture of the icons that this malware was behind, and I was sort of wishing they had done a better job of blurring the adult themed icons, because they weren't quite blurry enough. But there are all these apps in the non-Apple Play Store, you know, non-curated repositories, and I'm sure there are people who are wanting to get things for their Android devices that you can't get from the Google Play Store, but getting them really is a mixed blessing. So I would say, you know, first of all, be very careful with where you obtain apps for your Android devices. And also, if the first moment you notice your phone getting hot, consider what you may have recently installed and get rid of it if you can, because if it happens to be this thing, it looks like it just basically melts down your phone given time, which seems a little, you know, antithetical to its purpose. If it destroys the hosting platform, then it's not going to get any more crypto mining there. But I guess they just want to squeeze it as hard as they can for as long as they can.
And then you'll get a new phone and install it then.
Exactly.
You need that wallpaper app. You gotta have it.
Yeah, that's right.
Although I have to say, you can't trust stores anymore at all. You saw that Apple had two counterfeit. We talked about one last week, and now there's another counterfeit app. Who's mining the store? I don't understand how this happens.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not malware. It was just ripping people off, but...
Or in this case, who's mining the store?
Now you have a title, I tell you.
That's right. Okay. And in a similar, I said that there were two instances of consequences of this increased pressure to mine. There's another campaign which has been named Zealot, Z-E-A-L-O-T, by the guys at F5 Networks who found it. It is mining, also mining Monero, which seems to be the one to go for these days, on Linux and Windows servers. The guys at F5 Networks found evidence of an aggressive and sophisticated malware campaign currently underway targeting Linux and Windows servers with an assortment of exploits whose goal is installing Monero cryptocurrency mining malware. And it's interesting. I mean, this makes sense when you think about it, because first of all, servers have a public, have a public internet facing presence, so you can scan for them and find them, and they're typically beefier than end user. Certainly, they're beefier than light bulb processors. You know, a server machine is going to have a lot of RAM and lots of cores and heat sinks and fans, and it's going to be a much more effective miner. So, it sort of makes sense that if somebody was thinking, scratching their head, you know, where can we find some ready-to-go CPUs to use for cryptocurrency mining? It's like, servers. Well, if you can get them. So the F5 guys noted that the attackers are apparently fans of StarCraft, since many of the names found in the code and the files of the campaign are taken from the game. First of all, of course, Zealot, but then also Observer, Overlord, Raven, and others, all apparently familiar to StarCraft fans, one of which I am not, but I take their word for it. So if for Linux servers, they are scanning for the now famous Apache Struts flaw, which, as we know, was the flaw used for the Equifax breach, and for on the Linux side, and the so-called .NET Nuke ASP.NET content management system vulnerability, which exists in unpatched Windows servers. So they're targeting both Linux and Windows using well-known previously fixed flaws, assuming that there are some machines they can find that are publicly exposed and don't have those things fixed yet. And essentially, so they're using that those problems to get into the system, then using Windows PowerShell to download and install the final stage malware in the course of Windows, or the Apache Struts flaw to use Python scripts, which apparently were lifted from the Empire Project, which is a post-exploitation framework, very popular, to then install the Monero miner software. So again, it's sort of clever that they're using, you know, scanning for publicly available servers and targeting servers because they're more effective crypto miners than, you know, people's light bulbs and toasters and DVRs that typically have, you know, much more modest processing power. I mentioned also at the top of the show something of concern currently, like as in right now, for vBulletin. vBulletin is one of the oldest, longest-running, very popular forum software. It was written, I think, initially in 1999, so 17 or 18 years old. It's gone through several versions. And then actually there's been some churn and some controversy as developers came and left, and Zenforo, which is the web-based bulletin or forum software that I ended up choosing, was written by some guys who left vBulletin in order to do a complete rewrite, and so there was some litigation as a consequence of that that ended up getting settled a few years ago. But in this case, web forum systems have been traditionally very difficult to secure. I mean, they have been, though not a lot recently, historically, they have really been a problem because their nature inherently allows remote users to submit posts which are stored typically on SQL server backends. Then those postings are parsed by the server and displayed on everyone else's browsers. So as we know, there are, you know, the the famous example of a user naming themselves, you know, Johnny Drop Table, which is combines some SQL commands with something that the server would read from the database while it's displaying the forum page. And I mean, actually has in the past caused tables to be deleted from the forum software. So I mean, so, and cross-side server vulnerabilities, I mean, all kinds of problems have surfaced on forum software because the framework being used had vulnerabilities which clever hackers were able to leverage for their own advantage.
Also, and actually, PHP is kind of horrible, and they're almost always in PHP.
Yes.
I think
yes.
vBulletin, was it a successor to PHP MyBulletin? I bet it was.
I think that's the case.
More modern version of that.
And so they've gotten better. And for what it's worth, because of this historical problem, I have built another server. Actually, I did it last summer. Ready to
isolated.
Be used.
Yeah.
Yes, and it is on it's on physical separately hardware. I have a physical firewall between it and the rest of GRC, and the entire network it's on its own physically isolated network because I just absolutely, you know, I mean, I'm not writing a bulletin board. Everyone's glad, but I'm not writing my own bulletin board system from scratch. I would love to, but no, that's just not practical. So what I'm doing is I'm using the best that I could find and I really like Zenforo, but I can't trust it, and I can't allow anything that happens there to infect the rest of GRC. So as you said, Leo, it's on a physically separate box with complete network isolation. So yes, if something nasty crawls into it, well, it'll be contained. Okay, so two different groups found found existing vulnerabilities in vBulletin, bad ones, remote code execution vulnerabilities, and that not only allowed them to execute code, but to do so with elevated privileges. In both cases, they contacted the vBulletin maintainers, and after more than a month, or I guess not quite a month actually, got no response, never received an acknowledgement, crap, we'll fix this immediately, nothing. So they went public with them. So And not only with the full disclosures, but also proof of concept code demonstrating these vulnerabilities. So they are in the wild. They are effective against the most recent version 5 of vBulletin, and they've not been patched. So I don't know. Unfortunately, there's no real takeaway. I don't know. It's not clear whether the servers that are hosting this vBulletin would be subject to compromise. Certainly they would. I guess it depends upon what the attacker wants to do. If the server's compromised, that allows them to get into the network that the server is residing on, and then probably spread from there. So they might just be using vBulletin's flaws as a way into the intranet that is hosting that server, meaning that users, you know, external public users of that vBulletin forum would not be attacked. On the other hand, if the vBulletin system has been compromised, it could be used to turn around and maliciously attack visitors to that forum. So I'll be keeping an eye out for updates. And of course, the problem is that many of these sites are not being updated regularly. So although it doesn't look, as far as we know, it doesn't look like there are any fixes to that now, which is why, you know, these problems were made public. Even when they are, forum software tends to lag and not to be kept current. And because of the history of problems and security problems, they are being updated by at least by people who are being responsible. I can't explain why there was no response from the vBulletin people. I haven't looked into like whether in general they are being responsible or not. If anyone's interested in more details, I have links and the various CVEs that have been issued to cover these vulnerabilities. But I mean, and in fact, you mentioned, Leo, about PHP, and that is absolutely the case here. The first vulnerability discovered in vBulletin is a file inclusion issue that enables remote code execution. A remote attacker is able to include any file from the vBulletin server and execute arbitrary PHP code against any file installed on Windows. The disclosure includes working proof of concept exploit code to show the exploitation of the vulnerability. And in this case, a CVE, the Common Vulnerabilities and Exposures Number, has not been issued. The second vulnerability has been assigned a CVE. It's 2017-17672 and is described as a deserialization issue that an unauthorized attacker can exploit to delete arbitrary files and execute malicious code in some circumstances. The vulnerability arises from the unsafe usage of PHP's unserialize function on user-supplied input. So in both cases, as you thought, PHP is the underlying problem because that's, you know, the implementation language for this BBS software, this forum software.
It always is. The problem with PHP, it can be written securely. It's just that it's so easy and it it allows you to – anybody to write code and doesn't really, it gives you all sorts of dangerous tools.
Yep.
It's not good.
Yep. Now, okay, and get a load of this. When I first saw this, I thought, what? Mozilla has gotten themselves in trouble.
Yeah, this pissed me off, actually.
Yeah, by force installing what is a promotional add-on relating to, of all things, Mr. Robot, you know, I mean, the Mr. Robot show. So Mozilla and Firefox stumbled into the doghouse last week when they used a facility called Firefox Studies, which is built into all recent versions of Firefox and enabled by default. So the takeaway for our listeners may be that you might want to consider disabling this because you can, which would have prevented this from happening. It didn't affect all users, but essentially what happened is that, and it's not clear whether it was done as a test or if they wanted to stick their toe in the water or what, because it didn't affect all users, but they installed this apparently promotional add-on without their users' knowledge or consent. So first of all, this Firefox Studies facility is something that allows Firefox's developers to update their users' browsers with additional code for whatever purpose they may have. In this case, it took the form of an add-on named Looking Glass version 1.0.3. And, you know, Looking Glass is a mystery. It's not clear what that's about. However, this Firefox Studies can be disabled on Firefox by opening under the settings, going to privacy and security, and turning off, quote, allow Firefox to install and run studies. So this was done under that settings default enabled state. So Mozilla's own support page said, which they put up to explain what was going on, they called it through the Looking Glass, and they said, what's happening? They ask rhetorically, are you a fan of Mr. Robot? Are you trying to solve one of the many puzzles that the Mr. Robot team has built. You're on the right track. Firefox and Mr. Robot have collaborated on a shared experience to further your immersion into the Mr. Robot universe. This is them writing this. Also known as an alternate reality game, ARG. The effects you're seeing are part of this shared experience. No changes will be made to Firefox unless you have opted in to this alternate reality game. Okay, except they installed an unwanted add-on. So I would call that a change made to Firefox. Then they ask themselves, how do I opt in or out? To participate, install the Looking Glass add-on from, and then they have the add-on, you know, Looking Glass link. I have it in the show notes if anyone wants it. This add-on is available only in the U.S. in English. Then they say, if you no longer wish to participate in the shared world experience, enter About:Add-ons into your address bar and remove Looking Glass. And then they say, kind of confessing here, Looking Glass was previously delivered as a shield study. So you might see Looking Glass 2 or Pug, P-U-G experience in your past studies in About:Studies. It has already been removed as a study and moved to an add-on, so you do not need to take any further action. Anyway, this whole thing is a mess. And as you said, Leo, it has angered a lot of Firefox users that like Mozilla was doing something like involving something that seems to be promotional. It's like,
I don't know if they say they weren't paid, but that's just dumb then.
Yeah, exactly. Right? Not to have at least gotten something in return.
Didn't make it better, just make it dumb.
Yeah, so wow. You know, and the problem is, you know, I guess they didn't want to push a question out to all Firefox users, you know, are you watching Mr. Robot? Do you want to participate in an alternate reality game? You know, that would have been annoying too.
I will install the extension.
Yes.
Don't put that in your main install. That's ridiculous.
Yes. Yes. And don't push it in any way. You know, somehow, I don't think there's a good way to ask a generic browser user who you have no reason to believe has any interest whatsoever in Mr. Robot, good as it may be, you know, there's just no way to inflict that upon them. That's not Mozilla's job. They really do, as you said, they need to stay neutral. So, you know, bad on them. Okay, and this wasn't advertent or deliberate on Windows 10's part, but it's kind of a problem when Windows 10 has chosen to bundle and install a password manager in all Windows 10 systems, which turns out to be vulnerable and turns out to have known that it to have been vulnerable. Our good friend, Tavis Ormandy, he wrote in the Chromium bug project under Project Zero, his title was Keeper: Privileged UI Injected into Pages Again. And Tavis wrote, I recently created a fresh Windows 10 VM with a pristine image from MSDN. That's, you know, the Microsoft Developer Network. That's, you know, I'm a member, and Microsoft developers are. You're able to get what?
Well, I just want to point out that seems to be in the MSDN version. It's not in any version. I've tried all my Windows machines. Keeper is not installed in any of my Windows machines.
So
it must be something they put in MSDN for developers as a kind of here you go.
Oh, good.
Yeah. I mean, at least I can't find it. Maybe people could. I'll ask tomorrow on Windows Weekly. Obviously, we'll be talking about it.
There is a Reddit link I have in the show notes where again, I didn't go there to look. So let's hope that it never went public. That would be great. Because,
well, they put stuff in MSDN versions of Windows. They don't put in other versions of Windows, I presume, for developers.
Okay, good. So I don't know either way. But anyway, Keeper that was in this MSDN version, which, it did have a problem that Tavis had previously reported to them. He did say he's not the only person who's noticed this with a link to Reddit, but it may have been other developers. I don't know whether it was in the public or not. So I'm glad you add that caveat, Liat. He says, I assume this is some bundling deal with Microsoft. He said, I've heard of Keeper. He said, and I remember filing a bug a while ago about how they were injecting privileged UI into pages. Into web pages. He says, I checked, and they're doing the same thing again with this version. I think I'm being generous considering this a new issue that qualifies for a 90-day disclosure, as the same attack still works. Nevertheless, he said, this is a complete compromise of Keeper security, allowing any website to steal any password. Here is a working demo that steals your Twitter password. And he provides a link to a demonstration of this happening. So the tech press coverage said, you know, it had headlines like, for 8 days, Windows bundled a password manager with a critical plugin flaw, which, you know, may or may not be overblown depending upon whether this was actually pushed out to end users. So the good news is the Keeper folks responded instantly to Tavis, fixed the problem by removing some functionality that contained this problem and had all of the patches pushed out within 24 hours. So Keeper itself, I guess, has been around for years, and it's a well-known password keeper extension available on Edge and Chrome and Firefox. The takeaway for our listeners is you want to make sure if you're a user of Keeper that you're at 11.4.4 or newer, since they fixed that moving forward. So anyway, I guess we'll find out whether it ended up being made public or whether this was just MSDN. I don't know. I think that Tavis is suggesting that, you know, this was the image that, well, we know he's suggesting that it's the, or he's saying that it's the one that was, that he got from Microsoft. Who knows whether it went out public. And Leo, time for me to sip my coffee.
Indeed, indeed, indeed. And I'm just asking the chat room, if any of them saw Keeper installed. And it looks like I have Keeper on the fall edition, just my luck. So some people might have it. That's KenNote 2. That's interesting. I mean, I've used Keeper. I wonder if that bug in Keeper is similar to the bug. There was a cross-site bug in LastPass as well that was fixed, right? Is it similar to that, I wonder, or maybe something else?
I think what upset people is, as I understand it, is unlike other Windows 10 bundles where you get a link to install something, this actually installed it. I mean, it was there in, you know, installed by Microsoft with this update. And as we now learn, for a window of 8 days, apparently there was this vulnerability present.
Yeah. More to research will be done, and we will report back. I mean, it may be they put an ad for it, but that still doesn't install it. You have to.
No, it's installed.
You say it was installed.
So, for example, here in Reddit, I just reinstalled Windows 10 today, and I was uninstalling all the bundled apps like usual, and I noticed that Keeper Password Manager is pre-installed now. I've never seen this come installed with Windows before.
The Windows 10 I'm using was installed from the Windows 10 Media Creator and does not have Keeper installed, does not even have anything promoting Keeper installed. So I just don't know. Yeah, it's unclear. But I'll ask Paul Thurrott. Windows has many versions. Many versions of Windows exist.
Ah, yes. Not simple.
Our show today is brought to you by our friends at IT Pro TV. A good IT pro is always learning. And the best way to keep up to date, something fun and easy and affordable like IT Pro TV. Whether you're looking to get into IT or take your career to the next level or just, you know, expand your knowledge, IT Pro TV is awesome. They kind of were inspired by what we do here at TWIT. Imagine, if you will, TWIT, but with 125 hours of programming every week. They've got five studios and focused very intently on IT issues like, you know, how to use Kali Linux or Linux security techniques or getting the ISC squared certs or the A plus certs or all of those security certs. You can learn, you can get the Certified Ethical Hacker cert. Well, you don't get it from this, but you get the background, the information you need to know to take the test. They have practice tests online. They have study groups. They now have over 3,300 hours of on-demand training, and then they're adding more fast all the time. You can watch it, of course, on your browser, on your tablet, but also on a Chromecast. They have Roku apps. They have Amazon Fire TV apps, Apple TV apps. They have iOS apps, and they have Android apps. So basically, any way you could imagine watching it, you can. And if, by the way, if you have an IT team and you're sending them off-site for training, keep them on-site and set them up with IT Pro TV. All the certs are in there. CRISC, CISSP, CISM, CISA, as I mentioned, CEH. And if you're an individual, get an individual membership. We've got a great deal for you. If you have a team, take a look at this team solution, and I'll show you how you can get a demo of that for free. But you get group pricing, access to the supervisor portal, which gives you control over the schedule. You can assign training. You could check how, you know, courses were completed. View logins, viewing time, video downloads, create custom groups, see individual and group analytics. It's friendly training with great binge-worthy content and, man, life-changing results. IT Pro TV, more than 85,000 IT Pro TV members now. I would almost guarantee at least half of them listen to you, Steve Gibson. They listen to this show. ITPro.tv/security. Now, you find out how you can get great training for you as an individual, 7-day trial for free, and when you sign up for an individual monthly membership and use the code SN30, you get 30% off your subscription for the lifetime of your active subscription. SN as in security now, 30 as in 30% off. But also you can get a demo of the supervisor portal if you're looking at the team solution. ITPro.tv/security now. Don't forget SN30 for a 7-day trial, 30% off. You don't need to use that code for the team portal. Just say, hey, I want to try that team portal. See how that works. ITPro.tv. Become a true IT professional like this guy right here.
So the coverage of this talked about Windows 10, but this is really not a Windows 10 issue. The problem is much bigger than that. There's a technology which has been around since the very beginning of the early days of the internet, even before 1996, known as proxy autoconfig. The problem is that the problem that this was intended to address is that a browser comes alive in a, like, wakes up launched in a machine, and it needs to have a way to get to the public internet. Yet there may be no direct connection. It may need to run through a proxy, but it may need to be configured for that. And those of us who've been around a long time may remember the days when that you could manually configure the proxy, and, you know, those dialogues are still around if you're for whatever reason there isn't an auto config. Well, there is this auto config capability, which is a protocol that Netscape, I mean, the Netscape back in the early Netscape Navigator days, they designed it, and they decided that the file which would be used, a PAC file, would be JavaScript. So not XML, not something less capable, but full-on JavaScript. So, you know, probably because that's the language that they had in the browser already. And they said, oh, let's just, you know, have the autoconfig operate by running a JavaScript script. So it's okay, we have that. Now, the next problem is, where do we get this file? How does the browser know to get the file? Or maybe how does the Windows OS itself know to configure access for itself to the internet? And so essentially, all Windows systems have this proxy autoconfig, and the protocol that carries it, WPAD, Web Proxy Auto Discovery Protocol, enabled by default. It exists because it's a standard. It is also, it's not just something random that Netscape came up with. It exists as an IETF draft, which, although it expired in 1999, here we are in 2017, and every Windows machine will ask the network when it boots up, essentially, hey, where can I find a JavaScript file to execute? It asks for this through DHCP and then DNS and then the WINS, WINS, and maybe even some other solutions. So basically, it casts about all over the local network querying for anyone who will respond with the URL where this JavaScript file can be found and executed. Even Chrome does this, but it executes the JavaScript in a sandbox to limit any damage that can be done. The problem with Windows is that even though there are newer JavaScript interpreters available, it still uses the old original JScript engine, which has a whole bunch of known vulnerabilities. So Google's Project Zero guys took a look at the JScript engine and generated a complete soup to nuts execution exploit. And what's a little more worrisome is that there are a number of ways of actually pulling this off. For example, if you are a machine on an intranet where a Windows machine comes up and first sends out a DHCP broadcast saying, I need the WPAD PAC proxy autoconfig file. If you beat the legitimate DHCP server that may be running on that intranet, assuming that there is one, if you beat it to the punch, you're able to provide the URL to the Windows machine for its configuration and essentially cause it to run JavaScript of your own design. And unfortunately, since it runs it on the older JScript engine, probably for compatibility reasons, because in fact it was the lack of features in JScript gave the Project Zero guys some headaches because they couldn't run their normal JavaScript find bugs in JavaScript code because there were too many things that were not supported by the old JScript. So I'm sure that it's still running JScript specifically because it wants to be able to leverage for compatibility reasons, the code that once a long time ago ran and is still being run today. So the big problem is that there's a list of things that's being done. If no WPAD PAC file URL is obtained from DHCP, then DNS is queried. And believe it or not, it's queried publicly, so that there have actually been exploits in the wild where a public WPAD DNS URL was used, was being asked for, and a URL returned that a system would then execute. And it's .local is the domain, but it is being made publicly to the public DNS. So it turns out that the Google guys came up with a way of answering the query, which are going out into the public, generating some code, which would be executed on any version of Windows. They talk about Windows 10, but there's no reason that it wouldn't work on any version of Windows for the last 10 years at least, and take advantage of flaws in the JScript engine in order to execute their own code. So they found multiple vulnerabilities, engineered a highly reliable proof of concept exploit. And the reason they just went public with this is that there's nothing necessarily to be fixed. I mean, this is all using long established standards through multiple editions of Windows. They suggest that the only thing, you know, the only solution they came up with was for Windows to disable looking for this WPAD PAC, the proxy auto config file, or to block it at your border so that your own intranet's queries don't go out into the public, or make sure you provide an answer locally so that you sort of snub the systems looking for this. And I don't know if anybody here who's listening to the podcast has sniffed internet traffic and intranet traffic. You see these WPAD queries all over the place. I mean, Windows systems are actively making these queries looking for an answer. The Project Zero has demonstrated that this represents a significant danger to Windows, for which there's no clear solution at the moment. So I thought that was a little bit chilling, but it's when old protocols that are still in use come back to bite us. We've talked about Mirai extensively, of course, because it generated the largest denial of service attacks the internet has ever seen. It brought down the very large DYN, the Dyn DNS service. Brian Krebs of Krebs on Security was under such a sustained high bandwidth attack that his long-standing service, Akamai, said, "We're sorry, Brian, we'd like to help, but these attacks are larger than we're able to afford and absorb, so you're going to have to find somebody else to host your DDoS protection for you." And we've talked about it. It was some routers and DVRs and basically internet appliances, internet-connected appliances that the Mirai botnet was more effective in corralling and commandeering and finding and spreading to than anything we'd seen before. And we've said on this podcast months ago, why? What is its purpose? What is its application? What is it trying to do? I mean, because it really frightened the security engineers and folks who track these things, generating multiple terabytes, terabits, I meant, of thousands of gigabits, thousands of megabits of attack traffic. Essentially, something that nobody could withstand. Well, The FBI got on the case and tracked down the origin of this.
Who was it? North Korea? China? Those Ruskies? Who was it? Who did that?
Three college kids. They were running.
Not so bright college kids either, by the way.
They were running a Minecraft server, and they wanted to attack other Minecraft servers and force them off the net in order to capture some of their Minecraft users. Apparently, and you know about Minecraft more than I do, Leo, but apparently if you run a popular Minecraft server, you can make money hosting Minecraft.
Sure you can, yeah.
And so these guys, so again, the dollar underpins the motivation. They wanted more users on their Minecraft server. So they said, okay, let's go blast some other Minecraft servers. So they built this botnet, which ended up being like way more powerful than they needed. So not only could they blast any Minecraft server that they could find, but it turns out that because DDoSing Minecraft servers is a thing, there are Minecraft DDoS hosts that specialize in hosting and providing bandwidth to Minecraft servers to protect them from DDoS attacks. Well, the Mirai botnet was so powerful that they were able to bring down the DDoS protectors, the Minecraft DDoS protectors, and essentially take all of the Minecraft servers off that were behind the Minecraft DDoS protectors. I mean, it was just this uber powerful, as we've discussed, just crazy powerful system. So the lead guy just pleaded, he's a college kid.
Rutgers.
Just pleaded, yes, at Rutgers.
Very proud
just
of him.
just pleaded guilty in an Alaskan court. He had two guys that he was working with. And our listeners will remember when we covered the fact that the Mirai source code had appeared online.
Senpai.
Yep, exactly. And we believed that it was presumed that the authors of Mirai had let it go public in order to obscure themselves so that other people would pick it up and start using it, so that in order to sort of like spread the blame around, essentially. Well, before they did that, the FBI was already zeroing in on this little trio. And so it turns out that they were not the people who blasted the Dyn DNS and brought all this attention to Mirai. Their own use of their own bot, the original Mirai botnet, was more focused on Minecraft. But by releasing it to the public, they turned a lot of other, and here's your favorite word, Leo, miscreants loose.
Hey, you miscreants.
You
miscreants. Get off my lawn.
And it was other people who weren't probably themselves sophisticated enough or hadn't done the work of reverse engineering the various IoT devices. And remember that Mirai was sort of a living organism. Shortly after a new exploit was found, it would get incorporated into this botnet, so it was constantly increasing its power and sophistication. By releasing the source publicly, anybody could get on the Mirai bandwagon. And in fact, it was some other people that were involved in blasting Dyn DNS off the net and causing a big chunk of the eastern portion of the U.S. To go dark, as the caches of existing DNS queries drained, and people and the resolving DNS servers tried to go back to Dyn in order to get their records refreshed, but found that Dyn was off the net. So, anyway, that's the story behind Mirai. It was three college kids who didn't like competition from other people's Minecraft servers and thought, okay, we're going to, you know, blast them off the net, cause their systems to be slow, and thus collect other users onto our server.
Weren't they at some point selling DDoS as a service?
Yes, yes. There was also, it occurred to them, hey, you know, we could make some money by selling this to other people.
Hooligans.
Yes. What are you going to do? Unfortunately, I guess they're probably 21 by now. So
yeah,
they're probably being held responsible for, or probably
yeah.
18 rather. I'm sure they're 18.
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah.
Yikes. So, okay. I'm less overheated about this than several of our listeners who sent this to me. But Google does classify this not as a bug, but as a feature. And that is the fact that anybody can essentially steal all of another Chrome user's saved passwords, form fields, bookmarks, and history if they have physical access to their browser. Okay, well now, the reason this is not that big a deal is that we've already talked about how it's possible if you sit down in front of someone's computer who's using Chrome, with a few pokes around the UI, you can go to their passwords and tell it to show the passwords. And there they are. So, okay. So if you allow anyone physical access to your Chrome browser, or for that matter, many other browsers, you know, they'll let you see the passwords without having to authenticate. You know, it's just there. So someone posting on medium.com explained how that process can be done for all of the Chrome's synchronized saved things. And it doesn't take any great rocket scientist to do this. You sit down in front of somebody else's Chrome browser, go to Settings, Manage Profile, and then on that page, so it's Chrome:// /settings/Manage Profile, and then click on Edit Person, or you could go to Chrome:// settings/people, and then you sign that person out. So you sign them out of the browser. You then click Sign into Chrome and use your, or the attacker's Gmail account. So then Chrome helpfully notes that another user, and provides their Gmail account name, was previously using Chrome. And you're then given the choice of choosing between "that wasn't me" or "yes, that was me." So you say, "yes, that was me." And along with the "that was me" is "add my bookmarks, history, passwords, and other settings to," and then the attacker applied Gmail account. And then you click continue. And essentially, that's exactly what happens is all of the profile of that Chrome user who you just signed out from is assumed to be the same person, because you just said it was, as this other Gmail user, and all of their profile, including all their passwords, are merged into the newly logged in Gmail account. So again, the takeaway is just be aware of that this browser synchronization will work across Gmail accounts, and that if somebody had access to your Chrome browser, they could sign in as a new person and say, "oh yeah, that's me too," and merge all of your stored Chrome profile stuff into their own account, and then browse through it, use it, log in as you, assuming there's no second factor authentication at their leisure. So again, not a huge issue because that could be done on a site by site basis just through the Chrome UI, but this does do the whole thing at once, which certainly could be a concern. In a bit of – I didn't know where to put this, but I thought, okay, we haven't had any errata for a long time. So I got a tweet from a Drew Green who said, at SGGRC, been listening to previous episodes and heard you and Leo discussing Google's advanced protection program. A Bluetooth two-factor authentication device isn't necessary. He said, I found it works with an NFC YubiKey in place of a Bluetooth device.
Yeah, you can use the Neo, but you can't use it on an iOS.
Ah, okay. And so he said, works with an NFC YubiKey in place of a Bluetooth device, with the other device being a different USB-only YubiKey. So anyway, I wanted to add that to our knowledge base that you don't need Bluetooth. You can use an NFC YubiKey.
You so have that iOS might, or some or a phone without NFC. So
right.
YubiKey offers the Neo, which is an NFC capable YubiKey, as well as
right.
the YubiKey 4, which you should use because it's the more modern one. But you want the Bluetooth just because there's devices that don't use NFC.
Ah, okay, good. Good, good.
I think that's why Google just says it. I mean, you're right. They could qualify and say, if you have a device that doesn't support NFC,
right.
get the Bluetooth dongle.
Right. And a little bit of miscellany. There is a Be a Coder Humble Bundle, which had a whole bunch of No Starch Press books.
Some of my favorite
available.
List books in it.
Yes, 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 yes. And they look like actually a lot of fun titles in there.
Yeah.
So there's about 13 days remaining as of this podcast on December 19th. So it's called Be a Coder. So it's you can just go to www.humblebundle.com and you'll find it there. And four different sets of books. And I browsed through them. I mean, as you said, there's Lisp and
Learn You a Haskell for a Great Good is such a good book.
Uh-huh.
I have many of these books, actually.
Yep.
It's such a good book. I've not read Erlang. That's a kind of a copy of the classic by Miron. But, yeah, these are great. Closure for the Brave and True have that. Realm of Racket have that. Land of Lisp have that. You probably have the Art of Assembly language. I don't know.
I don't, but I know the author. He's at UC Riverside and has put together a very nice introduction to assembly language.
Randall Hyde, yeah.
Yeah.
This you know, everybody should. Now, these are just e-books, though. You don't get the physical books, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
Ruby Under a Microscope, Understanding ECMAScript 6. There's some good stuff in here. The Book of
Yeah,
R.
Of course, ECMAScript 6 is actually JavaScript.
Right.
So that is the
right.
current scripting language for our browsers. So it is the funds are donated. They offer donating or they suggest donating to the EFF, which of course is a great cause that we all support. Take a check out or take a look and check out this Be a Coder bundle. As you said, Leo, there's a bunch of good stuff
good
there.
Good stuff. Some real classics in here. Yeah.
Somebody got a kick out of doing some math with the current Bitcoin valuation. Zero Hedge noted, and thank you, Zyman Zarafa, for forwarding his tweet. Okay. Back when the FBI confiscated the Bitcoins, which were in the possession of Silk Road back then, they liquidated their Bitcoins and got a tidy sum, $48 million.
Oh, not bad. Mm.
But they would currently be worth $2.4 billion.
Jeez Louise. I just don't get this. It's a bubble, right? It's not. I don't understand it.
I like it.
You got some sitting in the corner there. What would it have to get to before you said, yeah, I really probably should. You know, I was thinking, you have a bad hard drive. Well, gee, it's too bad you don't know of any programs that can fix bad hard drives. Here's a guy who makes SpinRite. And he says, well, yeah, that's a bad hard drive. I don't know if I want to.
Well, actually, as far as I know, the RAID is fine. It was the motherboard that got lazy.
And so
I just moved the RAID to a different motherboard.
Yeah, that's easy.
It's probably there. So, Tavis.
You're just going to sit on it, aren't you?
I'm going to kind of wait and see what happens.
What if it got to like 100,000? Then you'd be worth $5 million. What if it got to 1 million? Then you'd be worth $50 million. I'd take it. But then do you cash in? Maybe it'll get to 5 million.
Maybe it's going to pop and crash.
It's going down. It's six. It's now at 17.5 again.
Yeah.
I don't know what to do.
Okay, so Tavis tweeted a little something sort of short and pithy, which I just liked because this is what we do on the podcast. Everyone, he tweeted, everyone wants there to be simple answers in security, but sometimes there are no simple answers. And, you know, we've often said that. It's like, you know, I was thinking of that in the context of Squirrel, that it's a two-party system. I want it to be as easy to use as possible. I want it to be bulletproof. But as I have said, the user has to bear some responsibility. That's going to be a sticking point because everybody's used to having I don't know what that is. I forgot my password. Click this link. I mean, it's incredibly insecure to do that. I mean, you know, it's all we've got. It's possible to have much more secure solutions. But, you know, they're just not there. As Tavis says, everyone wants simple answers in security, but sometimes there are no simple answers. It's true. And I did want to just follow up with the iOS 11.2.1 and both for iOS and for tvOS, that the anticipated patch that we discussed last week to fix the problem in HomeKit did happen. So iOS is now at 11.2.1. Which fixed that HomeKit vulnerability and restored that remote access for shared users, which they had briefly neutered at the server side in order to fix a couple of those problems that we discussed at greater length last week. And also, speaking of Bitcoin and liquidating, Leo, a bunch of people said to me that any sale would qualify as a capital gain as long as the asset had been held for more than a year. I wanted to verify that because it would be a significant effect. And I verify, yes, they are, in fact.
Oh, they're since an investment,
it,
really, right?
It is the case that I've had them for many, many years. It would be treated as a capital gain, as the sale of a capital gain held for a long time or long term. The U.S.
Better, if this new tax bill passes, you're a corporation. It was a corporate creation. It's a mere 21%.
Yep. Well, actually, as a capital gain, it's 15.
Oh, 15.
So,
we're happy now.
So, yeah.
Or you could just pretend you didn't get anything. How would they know? Maybe they listen to the show.
Yeah. Well, and Leo, you know, as I said, if I were behind bars, people might look askance at my security advice.
That's a good point.
So I was like, excellent. How good a security expert is he when he's been locked up?
Excellent point.
Anyway, and we all know I'm not greedy by nature, so what the hell? Okay, two notes about SpinRite real quick, just tweets. Nothing makes my day more than # SpinRite saves the day. Philip with two P's, PHILIPP, tweeted, SSD drive was failing, had everything backed up, ... except my private GPG key. Damn! ! Uh-oh. In his tweet. He said, a level 2 on the drive took 26 hours, but the drive was mountable again, and I rescued the key. Thanks for a great product.
Nice.
So once again, this is why there will be a SpinRite 7, is because it turns out it fixes solid state drives too. Who knew? That's I'm going to keep the name. It's not going to be you know, SSD write or anything. No, it's got to be called spin write, even though it's not spinning anymore.
Someday you'll have to do a bit saying, you know, it's called spin write because in the old days, hard drives moved.
Once upon a time.
You may not remember.
And also, Gregory Paul said, my two USB keys booting my FreeNAS failed both around the same time. Thanks to @SGGRC for SpinRite, which bring them back online. I didn't really read this closely, but so which he's saying brought them back online in time to migrate from USB keys to an SSD. So he said # FreeNAS and # SpinRite. And I should mention that one of the things you want to make sure FreeNAS is not doing is swapping at all. You want to make sure that your swap drive is in RAM, because you absolutely don't want to have an unnecessary swap drive for an instance of Linux or FreeBSD, which is actively swapping on solid state memory, because it'll kill it. So I don't know that that's how these two USB keys died, but because we know that they do tend to die. Thank you, Gregory, for sharing the fact that SpinRite was able to bring them back, and I'm really glad because it's much easier, obviously, just to copy those over to an SSD and then boot that. But for what it's worth, anybody running any sort of a turnkey system from a solid state drive, whether it's an SSD or any kind of non-volatile memory, make sure that your swap drive is not on that physical media. You want it to just be on RAM, in RAM, because as we know, that media does not like to be written to. And Leo, last break.
All right, last time for 2017. I'm excited about your next episode. If you subscribe to the show, you're going to be getting it. Our show today brought to you by our friends at Rocket Mortgage. Quicken Loans is the creator of Rocket Mortgage, one of the best lenders in the country, many time number one in customer satisfaction from J.D. Power and Associates. In fact, for the last 8 years running, they just got it again for 2017 for the mortgage approval process. And that's where they really shine with this new Rocket Mortgage. They created something for the 21st century. See, Quicken Loans realized the mortgage approval process really was stuck in the 19th century. It needed a customer-centric, technologically sophisticated system. And they said, we're going to do this. We're going to do Rocket Mortgage. And here's what it is. It's an entirely online mortgage approval process that is completely transparent. You see every step of the way what's happening. It's incredibly simple. You could do it on your phone. It's really fast. It just takes minutes. And then you will be able to mortgage with confidence. Not just mortgage. I got to point out, the Fed raised interest rates 0.25%. I think when they did that, they said we expect 3 more in 2018. That's a full point in the federal interest rate. That generally means your housing interest rates are also going to go up, no matter what they're tied to, the Fed or the LIBOR or cost of living or whatever. They're going to go up. So if you've got a mortgage, now's the time you might want to look at refinancing. No easier way, no faster way than Rocket Mortgage. Here's what you do. Go to rocketmortgage.com/securitynow. They'll ask you a few simple questions. You can actually, if you're thinking about it, just set up an account. And then when you're ready to buy a house or ready to refinance, they'll ask you a few simple questions. You answer those. They are partners with all the financial institutions. They get the information they need with your permission. You don't have to go to the attic to get, bank statements. You have to. Last time we bought a house, I was calling the bank and calling everybody that I'd ever done business with, trying to get old statements and old pay stubs. It was crazy, crazy. This is all. They do it all for you. Once you get permission, they crunch the numbers, and within minutes, they will tell you, okay, based on income, assets, and credits, you qualify for these home loans. What do you want your interest rate to be? What's your down payment? What's your term? And boom, you're approved for the loan that's right for you. It's that fast, that simple, that easy. You will feel great about it. And boy, there's no better feeling than You could even do it while you're in a house. You're looking at a house and saying, well, maybe we should buy this. And surreptitiously, while you're walking around with a realtor, you go, and before you're done, you say, well, wait, I just checked. We are approved for the mortgage for this house. Put you right at the front of the line if you're making an offer. RocketMortgage.com/security now. Go there now, set up an account or bookmark it. RocketMortgage.com/security now. Equal housing lender licensed in all 50 states. NMLSConsumerAccess.org number 3030. It's the most expensive thing you'll ever buy, but it's the greatest thing you'll ever buy. RocketMortgage.com/security now. We thank them so much for their support of Steve and all his efforts to protect you and stay safe. Buy a little coffee for Steve. Keep him humming along.
Okay. Border Gateway Protocol.
BGP. Not Bill Graham Productions. Border Gateway Protocol.
That was a blast from the past. Yeah. Okay. So we've talked a lot in the early days where we were discussing the way the internet works, about this, basically the invention, which is what it was back in the DARPA days, pre-internet, DARPANET, of autonomous routing. The idea being that you would have a federation of routers that are interconnected in just sort of a ad hoc, kind of random way. You want enough connectivity that if a link between any two routers went down, there would be like another way to get the data around where it had to go. So the idea being multiple paths. The internet is inherently a multi-path system where there are many ways, an incredible number of ways today, for data to get from point A to point B. That thus we get redundancy and resilience and so forth. At every router, in every router, there is a table, not surprisingly, called the routing table, which is a list of IP addresses, or more technically or more correctly, IP address prefixes, which instruct any incoming packet with the help of the router which outbound link to forward that packet to. I call them address prefixes because you couldn't and you wouldn't want every single IP address on the internet, and not just for the time being, restrict this to IPv4 for the sake of ease and explanation. There's 4.3 billion IPv4 addresses. So it would be impractical to have every IP address associated with which interface it goes out of. And it's not necessary, because one of the cleverest things, one of the many clever things about the internet is that networks are groups of adjacent numbered IPs. So, for example, and we've talked about this, HP, once upon a time, had 15 dot everything. In other words, they had every IP address, maybe I think it was 15 and 14, come to think of it. They had every IP address beginning with 15 or 14, which meant that anywhere else in the world, if a packet was bound for an IP address beginning with 14 or 15, it could be sent toward Palo Alto, back, say, that when HP was only in Palo Alto. The point being that one entry in a router, in the routing table of every router in the world, was able to just aim essentially, if it was two IPs, 14 and 15, that would be 1/128 of the entire address space, which is two IPs in class A of the first byte, 1/128, at a single location, dramatically simplifying the challenge of routing all 4.3 billion IPs to their destination. So this is this notion, this way the IP space is divided, is the bits on the left, the most significant bytes and technically bits, specify the network number, and then the right-hand bits are the machine within that network. So what that means is that, for example, a given company may have several blocks of IP addresses that are adjacent. Several, for example, Class C networks, a Class C being 256 IPs, maybe they have four of them. So that's 1024 IPs. Well, that means that the last 10 bits don't matter for routing because they just have to get to the company. Once they get to the company, then internally, the 1024 machines on those IPs will respond. But that means all the routers in the world, as long as the upper, let's see, we had the lower 10 bits, so the upper 22 bits, that specifies that company. So again, the routing table is simplified, and the company is probably buying its IPs from its ISP, and the ISP is selling similar blocks to many other companies, meaning that the ISP has a much larger network, so of like 10 for this company, 10 bits for that company, and so forth. So even fewer IPs on the bits on the left side will get the packets to that ISP. Then it uses the next chunk of bits to decide which company, which of its customers it routes the packets to, and then each of those companies routes them to its system. So just this incredibly brilliant hierarchical system. And to us, it's sort of, we can take it for granted now because we've been living with it for decades, you could almost say, yeah, well, that's, you know, obvious. Well, yeah, in retrospect, but these guys thought of this, invented it from scratch. So all over the world, we have routers containing these tables which need to figure out where to send stuff. And the challenge is, this is not, the internet is not a static environment. It is dynamically changing. And as I mentioned before, links between routers are coming up and down. If a link between two routers drops, then suddenly the routing table of both routers is wrong because they were wanting to send packets to each other. If each of them was nearer the destination of where those packets were trying to go, but if that link goes down, suddenly they need to update their routing tables to find the next best route in order to send the packets to, since the better route, the preferred route, is no longer available. So think about that for a minute. You have routers all over the globe that have tables that need to be managed continually and dynamically. You've got ISPs adding customers, removing customers. You've got, remember also, we've got IPv4 address space depletion, so that there are governments that used to have big blocks of IP space where IPv4 is suddenly valuable. It's a commodity. So they're selling off chunks of their network to other people who want to buy them. So suddenly IPs that used to route into that country now go somewhere else entirely. The point is, this cannot be done by hand. There's no possibility of managing and maintaining the tables of the routers that are global manually. BGP, the Border Gateway Protocol, is the protocol that automates this management. It is carried over TCP, so it so all routers establish persistent TCP connections to every other router that they're connected to. And I forgot what port number. It's 179, maybe. It's something like that. It's a well-known port in the same way that 25 is for SMTP and 80 is for the web and 443 for HTTPS and so forth. There is a well-known port which accepts TCP connections and only TCP connections, because we need to prevent spoofing. And routers establish a link to another router and communicate using BGP. Okay, so let's step back a bit, understanding how routers interact, the necessity of routing tables being maintained dynamically, the need to automate that process, and that BGP is what does it. The reason this all popped up on my radar is that exactly 1 week ago, there is a great site, bgpmon.net, bgpmon.net. They're a freely available open BGP monitoring site. They were purchased some time ago by OpenDNS. And as we know, OpenDNS was subsequently purchased by Cisco. They watch, among other things, but as BGPmon would suggest, they watch what's going on with BGP on the internet. A week ago, one of their guys posted the following. Early this morning, UTC, our systems detected a suspicious event where many prefixes for high-profile destinations were being announced by an unused Russian autonomous system. Okay, so let's stop back. We need to define some terms. Early this morning, our system detected a suspicious event where many prefixes for high-profile destinations were being announced by an unused Russian autonomous system. So first of all, prefixes is the term for the right-hand side of the IP. So that's called the prefix, as opposed to sometimes it's also called the network number, as opposed to the right side, which is the machine within that network. So those are prefixes. They use the term announced because that's also part of the BGP jargon. A router announces to the world via BGP the networks that it has responsibility for. So for example, an ISP's border, or it's called an edge router because it's on the edge between the ISP and the public internet. An ISP's edge router will announce that it's managing the traffic. It's behind it are the following networks. And so it announces it by announcing prefixes, meaning essentially saying all packets that where the left number of bits match this prefix should come to me. Because the machines for those prefixes are behind this edge router. So send all that stuff to me. An autonomous system is the official nomenclature, the name. It's called an AS number, and thereby number. It is the the numerical designation for an ISP like I was just describing. So, you know, Cox or Level 3 or Google, Apple, any major player on the internet is an autonomous system. And I kind of regret that I didn't apply for one myself for GRC many, many moons ago, years ago, because what you get if you're an autonomous system is an AS number and your own allocation of IP space. The point is that, you know, when I've moved from as I used to be at XO to Level 3, and before that I was at Vireo and then Cogent, all of those movements have required me to renumber my IPs for GRC. It's not painless, and it can be challenging to not have any downtime or to minimize downtime. But if you're an AS, you have your own IP space, and it's portable, meaning that had I done that, I could have said to Level 3, okay, I want to now be hosted in your data center, and my AS number is as follows. And so essentially, their edge router would have begun announcing the prefix that I own, and traffic, the same IPs that were once going to, for example, Vireo, would have been rerouted, literally rerouted, to Level 3. No DNS would have changed. That IP space would have just moved to a different location. So, I mean, this is how cool the system works. And frankly, we owe the fact that this is even possible to the cleverness of the automation of this routing system that is behind the scenes. But as BGP Mon wrote, early this morning, our systems detected a suspicious event where many prefixes for high-profile destinations were being announced by an unused Russian autonomous system. Now we know what that means. A Russian located AS, like a big IP or ISP, was announcing prefixes, announcing that it was the owner of prefixes, that is big chunks of IP space for high profile destinations. They write, starting at 443 UTC, 0443 UTC, 80 prefixes, that is blocks of IPs normally announced by organizations such as Google, Apple, Facebook, Microsoft, Twitch, NTT Communications, and Riot Games were now detected in the global BGP routing tables with an origin AS of 39523, which is DV link out of Russia, meaning that this entity, this Russian entity, was claiming that it was Google, Apple, Facebook, Microsoft, Twitch, NTT Communications, and Riot Games, among others. They write, looking at the timeline, we can see two event windows of about 3 minutes each. So they were not long-lived. The first one started at 0443 UTC and ended at about 0446 UTC. The second event started at 0707 UTC and finished at 0710 UTC. Even though, they write, these events were relatively short-lived, they were significant because it was picked up by a large number of peers, and because of several new, more specific prefixes that are not normally seen on the internet. So let's dig a little deeper, they write. One of the interesting things about this incident is the prefixes that were affected are all network prefixes for well-known and high-traffic internet organizations. The other odd thing is that the origin, which was AS39523, has not been seen announcing any prefixes for many years, with one exception, which they note later. So why does it all of a sudden appear and announce prefixes for networks such as Google? Okay, I'll stop at this point. So the idea when they mentioned peers is that not only was it this AES, this Russian autonomous system, announcing that it controlled IP space that it did not, but the nature of BGP is propagation. That is, when I was speaking earlier, I talked about how the routers are all linked between. They're all interlinked inherently, and they establish links to all the routers that they connect to, and then they share their routing tables. So this bogus announcement, which is essentially bogus routing information, bogus routes, were stuck in one router, and it shared them with its peers. The peers said, "Oh, wow, look, this AS39523 suddenly is in control of these IPs." So that means rather than sending them somewhere else, we need to send them there. The other thing that I haven't mentioned yet is specificity. That is, the way routing tables work is that among a table with many entries, the entry which is most specific is the one that wins. Now, this is important. Take, for example, that government I mentioned. We have a government that owns a huge block of IPs, say a whole class A. Call it, I don't know, just out of the blue, 200 dot, everything, everything, everything. Then it sells a chunk of its IP space to someone else. So the point is that it is so that in order for that IP space to be useful to someone else, they have to obviously be able to receive the traffic bound for that IP space. So in the routing tables of the world, every single routing table in the globe, there is still the general entry 200 dot anything, anything, anything goes to whatever continent that government is on. But also now in the table, having sold a subset of their IPs, 200.20.anything.anything goes to the buyer. So the point is, there are now the way the routing table works, the incoming packet containing a destination IP is caused to match the most specific rule, the most specific entry in the routing table. In this case, while an incoming packet to 200.20.something.something does match 200.anything.anything.anything, it more closely, that is, it more specifically matches 200.20.anything.anything. So that's the entry in the table that is the controlling entry, and that specifies where to send the subset of the 200 dot anything, anything, anything packets. So here's the kicker, is that as this posting on BGPmon mentioned, the entries, the bogus entries that appeared in this Russian router were more specific. They were deliberately more specific in order to capture the routes and the actual traffic that would have otherwise gone to Google and Microsoft and Apple and Facebook and so forth. Okay, that was a week ago. That was 7 days ago. We've discussed these things in the past, and I want to remind us briefly about them. On Sunday, February 24th, 2008, also at BGPmon, because these guys have been around for a long time, they said for 2 hours, viewers across, get this, most of the world were unable to reach YouTube. The root cause of this outage was a flaw in the Border Gateway Protocol, which governs how routing data propagates across the internet. It began the previous Friday when the Pakistan Telecommunications Authority, Pakistan Telecommunications Authority, ordered the nation's ISPs, that is the Pakistani internet service providers, to black out a YouTube video it feared would trigger riots. Pakistan Telecommunication Company Limited, PTCL, Pakistan's largest internet provider, responded to the order by the government by blocking the entire YouTube site, in this case YouTube network, through a quirk in BGP that's readily exploitable by anyone. Listen to that. Anyone who controls a BGP-enabled router, which is an edge router or a border router of an autonomous system, an AS, such as PTCL is. PTCL connects to the internet solely through another AS, in this case, PCWW Limited, a Hong Kong telecommunications company. PTCL technicians, that is the Pakistani technicians, failed to warn PCCW, that is their parent provider, the ones that they connect to block the bogus route. So essentially, the Pakistani company PTCL deliberately put a bogus route for all of YouTube IP space into their own router so that nobody in Pakistan would be able to reach YouTube. But they did not tell their parent, PCCW, not to propagate that bogus route. Consequently, that bogus route spread through PCCW and out to the rest of the internet. That route got propagated globally, and for 2 hours, most of the world was unable to reach YouTube. Not from a denial of service attack, not through anything like crazy, some active, powerful attack, just an engineer in Pakistan entered a command into a terminal and forgot to prevent that known bogus BGP route from going global. And it did. And it created a 2-hour global blackout of a major network on the internet.
This is kind of seems like a huge vulnerability.
Exactly.
You could do it maliciously, couldn't you?
Exactly. Yeah. So that was February 24th. In the same summer, attackers arranged to cleverly misuse the Bitcoin Stratum protocol by deliberately hijacking IP addresses of the pool server IP block. An attacker was able to steal, at the time, $83,000 worth of Bitcoin. This was an advanced attack, not just from the Bitcoin perspective, but also from the BGP perspective. In an attempt to hide the attack, the originator used autonomous system path prepending, which is a way of hacking BGP with a range of autonomous systems. And I'll just note that later in that same year, in 2014, it was the same technique of spoofing BGP was used for by spammers. An unknown spammer was able to manipulate BGP to cause a block of IPs to get routed to them. While it was routed to them, they used it for spamming. And within a couple hours, before the anti-spam systems could blacklist their IPs, they shut down that block and opened another. So they were able to walk through a chunk of the internet's IP space briefly, commandeering it for the purpose of sending out a huge amount of spam, which would not be blocked by IP address filters because it was brand new and had never been seen sending spam before. And then before they could get filtered, or maybe the moment they sensed they were being, they shut that down and grabbed another block of space. So you got exactly the point I wanted to make, Leo. And the reason I wanted to spend some time talking about this is that we have a fundamental weakness in the internet, and mistakes happen and abuse happens. Routing errors can happen either deliberately or inadvertently. And we absolutely rely on this. There is continuous BGP protocol noise as routes are changing, on the order of 50 to 200 routing updates per minute are propagating through the internet. And there are high periods of churn where those who monitor see 9,000 updates of routing information per minute. So it's not something anybody is able to manage or take advantage of. And at this point, we're vulnerable. And so I would not be surprised. The reason I wanted to take the instance of this occurring for a couple minutes suspiciously by a Russian AS exactly a week ago is that I'm virtually certain that during the balance of this podcast's life, we will be talking about the apparent deliberate abuse of BGP, probably by state actors who certainly have the power to perpetrate these kinds of deliberate internet misrouting attacks. Really, really interesting.
Fortunately, nobody would want to do that. That would just be such a terrible thing to do.
That's just theoretical.
They'd have to have some status, though, some standing in the network. People don't just blithely accept new BGP rules, right? I mean,
they do. Yeah. Blithely accept new GP rules.
Well, that's terrible.
I know. It is. Yeah. And the problem is you can't. So there's no vetting system. Jeez. If that government sold a block of IP space, all it means is that somebody on an edge router somewhere says, we're now responsible for this block of IPs, please send them to us.
Jeez.
And it happens. It's not the first time
we've seen this. This has happened many times over the past years, right?
Yes.
These mistakes, BGP mistakes.
Yes, and they can be mistakes, or they can be deliberate. And
we've not seen any deliberate attacks using this, though, at this point, or have we?
For example, in that case of spammers squatting on stolen, basically they're stealing IP space in order to route spam, and then releasing it, and then stealing some more. So it is the case that you need to be an autonomous system, but the problem is there's no oversight, there's no clearinghouse, there's no one that you have to check with before you enter a block of IPs into a router claiming that it's yours, and it propagates across the globe, and now all of those IPs come to you. I mean, it is that bad. It's really, really worrisome.
It's pretty amazing.
It is.
All right.
Well, and on that happy note, we end 2017.
The midnight ride of Steve Gibson has concluded. The BGPs are coming. The BGPs are coming. Yes, and next week a fun one. We're going to have a lot of fun, and I'm looking forward to that. But that is a return of a classic episode, and not the whole episode, just the timeless part.
Yes, and it is an important, I think, something that very our important. Listeners will yeah. will really find very interesting. And then we'll be back all fresh-eyed and bushy-tailed, or whatever that expression is.
Bright-eyed and bushy-tailed.
Bright-eyed and bushy-tailed in 2018.
January 2nd. I don't know how bright-eyed or bushy-tailed I'll
wow.
be.
Ooh, yeah.
But that's what we will be here, 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern, 21:30 UTC on Tuesday, January 2nd. But again, next week, it's going to be a fun one. And I wasn't here for that episode. Tom Merritt was filling in. So it'll yep. also be the return of Tom Merritt to our airwaves. You must listen. Now, there are numbers of ways to listen to any given show. Certainly the first place to go is grc.com. That's Steve's website, where he has all sorts of good stuff, including, of course, his day job. Spinrite, the world's best hard drive recovery and maintenance utility. But he's got lots of freebies. And he has not only the audio version of this show, but a transcript, not just of this show, but all of it. Do you have all the shows, all 642 shows?
I had Elaine go back.
She went back in time. Okay.
Yep.
Wow. Which makes it a very searchable archive as well. So go to grc.com and get that. You can tweet Steve at SGGRC. He takes DMs of any length as well. And you can also find video as well as audio of this show on our site, twit.tv/SN, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. That way you'll get every episode, including next week's special holiday episode. Steve, I hope you have a great Christmas and a happy new year, and I will see you in 2018. Wow.
Will do, and I look forward to hearing about your catamaran adventure.
Woo!
And
can't wait.
Don't try to get too much sun.
I think it's going to rain the whole time.
Ah,
so
in that case,
that'll be a problem. But I will be taking my vitamin D, thanks to you.
Yes. Oh, good. Yep, and yep. On to 2018.
On to 2018. Thanks, Steve.
Okay. Bye. Secure.